Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Shoftim, the monarchy. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger returns with a podcast on Shoftim. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member at Pardes and serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parshat Shoftim, the parsha that concerns itself with the Jewish people taking full possession of the land of Israel. In a previous podcast, I discussed the four institutions of leadership, the judge, the king, the priest, and the prophet. Today, I would like to examine in more detail the institution of the monarchy. Let us begin by looking at chapter 17, verse 14. And when you will come into the land which the Lord your God is giving you, take possession of it and settle down in it. And you will say, I will place upon me a king like all the nations that surround me. Verse 15. You shall surely place upon yourselves a king whom the Lord your God will choose. From among your brethren you shall place upon yourself a king. You cannot place upon yourself a foreigner who is not your brother. The first thing to note is that the institution of the monarchy is critical in the process of settling the land. The Torah says, when you will come into the land, take possession of it, settle down in it. It seems to be that taking a king is part of the process of taking full possession of the land. The way it is presented in our text is that the request for a king comes from the people. Is this a requirement? Is this prophetic? Since this, in fact, is what actually happened later on, let us move on a little bit. Not only do the people request a king, but the request is to be like all the nations that surround them. When we read this verse, we can easily imagine the negative effect of this statement. The people have settled in the land, perhaps have become complacent, and seek what we would call normalcy, to be like everyone else. What, in fact, is the role of the king here? We have no idea. The Torah does not outline what the role of the king is. All that we know is that somehow the king is critical in establishing this people as a nation, in making them a goy, a nation among nations. When we move on to verse 15, God says, Som tasim alecha melech, you shall surely place a king upon you, which seems to be a commandment, which seems to be an imperative. And immediately we have raised the question, is appointing a king desirable, or is it a concession? Is the king a concession to the will of the people, to be a nation among all the other nations, to be normal, quote-unquote? Or is the appointment of a king a mitzvah, an imperative, divinely mandated? When we read the two verses, we seem to get a mixed message. When we continue reading verse 15, we immediately note the parameters within which the people have to appoint a king, the limitations that are placed. Number one, in verse 15, Asher yivchar Hashem Elokecha bo, someone whom the Lord your God chooses. And as the Ibn Ezra notes on this verse, someone who is chosen by a prophet or by the Urim v'Tumim. The appointment of a king is ultimately not the choice of the people. It is the choice of God and must be validated by God. On the other hand, the continuation says, from among your brethren you shall appoint a king, which seems to be saying that the people also have a say in who the king is, but he has to be somebody who is native, similar to the President of the United States. Someone born in the United States, someone who is not a naturalized citizen. And this point is emphasized in the end of the verse. You cannot place upon yourself a foreigner who is not among your brothers. So that on the one hand, the Torah is saying that the people choose the king. But on the other hand, God chooses the king. And it would seem to be, from the way it's presented over here, that perhaps both of these are possibilities. And perhaps what should happen is a dovetailing of the two. Which would mean that if God chooses the king, we nevertheless need the approval of the people. And vice versa. If the people are going to appoint a king, it ultimately needs to be validated by God and to be done within the parameters that have been outlined. And now let us read the next three verses, which outline the limitations placed on the king. Verse 16, only he should not increase his horses and should not return the people to Egypt for the sake of increasing the number of horses that he has. And God said to you, do not return on the path that you went on. Verse 17, he should not increase the number of wives that he has, in order that his heart should not be led astray. And silver and gold he should not increase greatly. The three limitations placed on the king are not having an excessive amount of horses, an excessive number of wives, an excessive amount of wealth. Horses are what give the king his military strength. Wives, in the ancient East, were very often the means to political alliances, political standing, and of course wealth, economic well-being. The Torah places limitations on these three elements, ultimately to limit the power of the king. As if to highlight this point, we then go on to verse 18. V'haya cheshivto al kisei mamlachto, and it shall be when he sits on his throne. V'chatav lo et mishnei haTorah hazot al sefer, and he will write a repetition of this Torah on a book, milifnei haKohanim halvim, before the priests and the Levites. V'haita, verse 19, V'haita imo v'karavo kol yemei chayav, it will be with him and he will read it all the days of his life. And here we come to the critical point. Leman yilmad, so that he should learn, liyira et Hashem Elokav, to fear the Lord his God. Lishmor et kol divrei haTorah zot, to guard all the words of this Torah, v'etachukim ha'ele, and these statutes, la'asotam, to do them. Levilti rum levavo me'achav, so that his heart should not be raised above his brothers. Ulevilti sur min ha-mitzvah yamin u'smol, and so that he should not deviate from the commandments to the right or to the left. Lema'an ya'arich yamim al mamlachto, in order that his days shall be prolonged on his kingdom. Hu uvanav bekerav Yisrael, he and his sons in the midst of Israel. The last point which is being made here is that the king has to write a Torah, we could even say a mini Torah, which accompanies him wherever he goes. And the purpose of having the Torah accompany him is to give him perspective, to create within the king a sense of profound humility before God. It is very clear from these verses that the Torah is very concerned with the possibility that an all-powerful king can ultimately become the replacement of God. And in order to make sure, to guarantee, that the king will know his place, we place these limitations so that he realizes that ultimately he is subject to God. Ultimately, he is not above the law. Ultimately, he is put in this position not to rule over his brethren, but ultimately to serve his people in God. This is the ideal king. As I mentioned at the outset, is this really something desirable, or is this a concession? If we turn to the book of Samuel, where we have the actualization of what it says in our section, this is Samuel 1, chapter 8, verse 4. And all of the elders of Israel gathered together, and they came before Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, behold, you have become old, and your sons have not walked in your ways. And now, place upon us a king who will judge us as all the nations. And in verse 6, and the matter was evil in the eyes of Samuel, when they said, give us a king who will judge us. And Samuel prayed to God. Clearly, the request for a king comes from the people. Exactly as it says in our parsha. They say, we want to be like the nations, as it says in our parsha. The way that it's presented here is, we want to have a king who will judge us. And it is clear that Samuel disapproves strongly with the request of the people. And then when we read on in verse 7, and God said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people, to all that they say to you, for they have not despised you, but they have despised me from ruling over them. From the day that they left Egypt till this day, they have forsaken me. They have worshipped other gods, and so have they done also to you. But now listen to their voice, and also warn them, testify, tell them what the rule, what the law, the judgment of the king who will rule over them. Once again, it is very clear that God is very unhappy with this request. The language, very sharp. The people have rejected me. And in fact, this is perhaps the culmination of a process which began from the moment the Jewish people left the land of Egypt, forsaking God, seeking other gods. Nevertheless, God says, do as they wish. But before you do that, the people who were so interested in the judgment of the king, God says to Samuel, tell them what that means. And then Samuel goes on from verse 11 through verse 18 to tell them what does it mean to have a king. Note the fact that in our parsha, we are not told in any way the job description. But in Samuel, we are told at least the powers of the king. And the powers of the king are terrifying. Absolute power. He will take your sons. He will take your daughters. He will take your fields and your vineyards, your servants, your slaves. You will become his servants. He will take your sheep. And in verse 18, and you will cry out on that day before your king that you chose, and God will not answer you. It is very clear that this description is meant to deter the people from asking for a king, but it doesn't work. The people refuse to listen, and they continue and ask, we want a king. And in verse 20, and we also will be like the other nations. Our king will judge us. He will go out before us, wage our battles. And here for the first time, perhaps, we are given a role of the king. The role of the king is to wage war, to lead them in battle. On a certain level, it is very understandable in the context for the Jewish people who are being harassed by their enemies, in particular the Philistines, who would like to somehow establish themselves as a nation, to rid themselves of hostile elements that surround them. In the end, God accedes to their request. Samuel hearkens to their voice. And as we know, he goes on to appoint Saul as the king. When we look at our parsha, the simple reading of the parsha would seem to say that appointing a king is an imperative. Som tasim alecha melech. When we read the book of Samuel, it seems to be that it is a concession. God is not happy with the request of the people. God sees this as a rejection. Which one is it? In Masechet Sanhedrin, in the tractate of Sanhedrin, 20b, there is an argument among the Tanaim. Rabbi Yossi says, three commandments were given to the Jewish people, to Israel, when they entered the land. To appoint a king, to cut off the seed of Amalek, and to build themselves the chosen house, the temple. And according to Rabbi Yossi, it's meant to be done in that order. Clearly, According to Rabbi Yossi, the appointment of a king is a commandment. He says three commandments were given to Israel. What is the linkage between the three things? Perhaps the first thing we should note is that after Saul is appointed king, the most significant task which he is given is to wipe out Amalek. And it is perhaps because of that that Rabbi Yossi says that after you appoint a king, the next step is to destroy Amalek. Why Amalek? Amalek represents two ideas. Number one, the denial of the existence of God, or we might say the embodiment of evil. And the second is the arch enemy of the Jewish people. In the words of Rav Soloveitchik, the nation that manifests unbridled hatred to the Jews. So that it would seem to be that the first role of the king is to, number one, eradicate evil, and number two, to remove those elements that are hostile to the Jewish people. Create a climate which can enable the Jewish people to ultimately achieve their goal. And it would seem to be that this actually happened during the time of David. David succeeded in removing the enemies of the Jewish people, first and foremost the Philistines, in laying the infrastructure for the Jewish people actualizing their destiny. But then we come to the next step, which is to build the temple. It is not enough to just eradicate evil, but it is important to do good. It is not enough to just remove Amalek, but it is important to establish the presence of God among the Jewish people. And that is reflected in the building of the temple. And as we know, this in fact was accomplished by King Solomon. So that if we take the position of Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yossi says there are three commandments that were given to the Jewish people and sees them being, in succession, appoint a king who will destroy Amalek, who will then go on to build the temple. And Rabbi Yossi perhaps bases himself on what in fact happened. The first king of Israel, King Saul, was given the task of destroying Amalek. David succeeds in removing the enemies of the Jewish people. His son Solomon goes on to build the temple. Rabbi Yossi represents one stream from the time of the Mishnah to the present day, which sees the monarchy as being something which is very, very positive, something which is mandated, with the model being King David and King Solomon, where that model ultimately reaches its ideal expression in the Messiah King, who on the one hand, according to Maimonides, based on verses in Micha and also in Isaiah, sees the role of the king in the end of days, the Melech HaMashiach, to wage the battles of God against the enemies of the Jewish people. But at the same moment, his role is also to rebuild the temple, to usher in an age where all will come to know God. Why a monarchy? Because a king is a very powerful figure. And perhaps in order to be able to make such momentous changes, you need to have someone who is all-powerful, who will be able to rally the people around him to achieve those lofty goals. Yet in that same place in the Talmud, in Masechet Sanhedrin, we have a dissenting opinion. Rabbi Nahorai says, the parsha of appointing a king was given only in response to their murmurings, as it is written, and when you shall say, let us appoint over ourselves a king like all the nations around us. Rabbi Nahorai clearly sees the appointment of a king as being a concession to the Jewish people who are murmuring. Clearly, Rabbi Nahorai focuses on the passage from Samuel and sees this ultimately reflecting the attitude of God and of the Torah towards a king. You have rejected me. You have abandoned me. Why do you need a king when you have God? Why do you need a king to judge you? Why do you need a king to wage your battles? God will do that for you. God can do that through the agency of a prophet, of a leader. It's very interesting to note that in Parshat Pinchas, when Moshe is made once again aware of the fact that he will not bring the people into the land of Israel, this is chapter 27, verse 16. Moshe says to God, "May God, the Lord of the spirits of all flesh, appoint somebody over the community." Verse 17. "Who will go out before them, who will bring them in, who will take them out, bring them in, so that the community of God will not be like sheep without a shepherd." And at that point, God says to Moshe, "Take Joshua, a man who has spirit, place your hand upon him, and appoint him to be the leader." Moshe asks God to appoint somebody to be a leader of the people. It is very interesting, though, that Moshe does not speak of a king. Moshe does not speak of being like the nations around us. Moshe speaks in the language of appointing a shepherd over his flock. The king may take the people out and bring them in, and I would suggest taking them out means leading them in war. Bring them in means consolidating them during peace, building their internal mechanism. In effect, the dual role which I mentioned before, the dual models of David and Solomon. But Moshe does not use the language of a king, but rather of a shepherd. And perhaps this is what Rabbi Nohorai is addressing. The people want a king, someone who is all-powerful. But to what extent is it that the king can become a replacement for God? As God says, "They have rejected me, they have detested me." And this is ultimately the culmination of a process of seeking out other gods. As I mentioned, throughout the ages, there has been one position represented by Rabbi Yossi, but an alternative position presented by Rabbi Nohorai of seeing the monarchy as being extremely problematic. Perhaps the most outspoken critic of the monarchy was the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel, who explicitly says that we see with our own eyes how kings are corrupt and are only concerned with their self-aggrandizement. The Abarbanel, who experienced the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, who was very familiar with the Spanish court, and ultimately became very disillusioned with the monarchy. On the one hand, we have David and Solomon, who become together the model of the ideal king. But on the other hand, we have the bulk of the Book of Kings, which outlines the corruption of the kings. Their corruption in terms of idolatry, their corruption in terms of exercise of power, not to mention the world at large, where kings were not a model of righteousness. I would just like to add, even the two models that we have of righteous kings present their problems. King David, we have the story of Bathsheba. Although David in the end repents and is forgiven by God, yet nevertheless that incident sets in motion a process which ultimately ravages his monarchy, which leads to the rebellion of his sons. There's a tremendous amount of political intrigue in David's court, among his sons, Avshalom, Adoniah, among his general, Yoav. Solomon, who ushers in an era of peace and harmony, who builds the temple. But the rabbis have their problems with him as well. And there is a very famous rabbinic comment which says that in general the Torah, I am now quoting a passage from Masechet Sanhedrin. Rabbi Yitzchak said, this is Sanhedrin 21b, "Why were the reasons of the Torah, the reasons of the mitzvot, not revealed to us?" And his answer is, "For there are two verses where the reasons were revealed, and a great man stumbled over the mitzvah. The Torah says you should not increase the number of horses that you have in order not to bring the people back to Egypt. You should not increase the number of wives that you have so that your heart will not go astray. And Solomon said, I will increase, and I will not go back to Egypt. I will increase, and I will not go astray. Solomon said, I know myself. I know that I will stay within the parameters. But ultimately, he failed. He brought the people back to Egypt to buy horses, and it says that his wives in his old age led him astray. So where does this leave us? I think that our parsha perhaps creates a certain dialectic over here, a dialectic which is very difficult to resolve and which I would like to leave open-ended. On the one hand, there is something extremely positive about having a powerful leader. Without a powerful leader, things don't get done. If you want to create a revolution, you need to have strong leadership. As clearly seen in King David, King Solomon, Hezekiah. But at the same time, the more powerful a person becomes, the more they become carried away with their power. The more they need to be put in check, to always keep perspective, that ultimately they are subordinate to God. That ultimately they are there to serve the people. And unfortunately, there have been too many examples of powerful people who have taken advantage of their position to the detriment of their subjects and of the world at large. In an ideal world, perhaps we don't need to have a king. Perhaps we need what Moshe asked for, a shepherd, a leader. People do need a leader. They need to have a focus. There may be certain situations where you need to have a very, very powerful leader in order to be able to move forward. But at the same moment, it becomes important to always be able to find those checks and balances so that ultimately the leader does not destroy the people. Today we live in an age where many people would say we have a crisis of leadership, or I should say a crisis in terms of lack of leadership. And perhaps there's the desire, the need to find someone who can be, in the words of the Chumash, raised above the people, to be able to show them a direction, to be able to somehow crystallize them. But it is always important to note that the leader is there to serve. The leader is ultimately not above the law. The leader is to always be aware of the fact of God who is above him. May we merit to have leaders who truly care about the people, who are interested in promoting a better world, and through that, create a reality where ultimately what matters is the service of God and the Jewish people. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send an email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.